So yesterday, Sayadaw spoke about ill will, about dosa, anger, and the dangers of anger. Today I want to speak about the opposite side of that same coin and about how we construct anger, identification, and the importance of understanding this and the importance of having some confidence in how we move through it. Because you're right in the middle of this retreat. It's interesting territory, sometimes interesting with a capital I, you know, it's like, whoa, not fun, but things are definitely happening. And as we've said before in the first half and also in the second half, this metta practice is a purification practice. And what it purifies is self-centeredness, ego-based preferences, ill will, hatred, resentment, fear. That's its job. That's what metta does naturally. And it's such a beautiful thing to transcend all of that, all of those personal preferences, where disconnection disappears. And those of you working with the neutral category, the unknown people of the world, this vast number of people that we don't even know their names, know nothing about them. Most of the population of the planet is unknown to us. But it's possible to connect. And that's a beautiful thing. It's also a beautiful thing when we transcend our collective preferences, where somehow non-human beings are less than human beings. And those of you working with the category of all beings are in this realm. You know, what makes an ant or a bee somehow less than us? This is where we live from, most of us, as human beings. But they're living beings, just like us, and they deserve to be happy. And there are 9 million plus other living beings on this planet, biological living beings. That's a vast field of metta that we tap into. And that's a beautiful thing. And it's a beautiful thing when our minds open to the great mystery of the unknown beings in the world and in the universe. Where we can say, well, I don't know these beings from my experience, but whatever, may they be happy. All of these are beautiful, and you've all experienced that to some extent or another. When purification of all that preference happens, but do you think that ego or conditioned preferences of lifetimes will go down without a fight? Yeah, of course not. And even if intellectually we come here knowing there's no magic bullet to how we suffer on account of those preferences, there may be this idea lurking in the mind that, you know, somehow this retreat will fix or transform us, you know, completely. And this part of the retreat is when that background assumption begins to be, to get a little reality check. Because it's with these categories of unknown beings and enemies, the ego defenses really begin to be breached, and where the ego really begins to fight back. And so it can really be useful to look at how those ego defenses, what are they made of? How do we construct them? And to notice how at the core of how we suffer in this practice and in life, those ego defenses are what is there creating that suffering. At the center of it all is a sense of identification with something, with preferences, with injury, with liking them as they relate to us or disliking them as they relate to us. And that reality check that this time in the practice gives us is really so precious, because this is where we go to that place in the Metta Sutta where we are straight. Very straight. We're very truthful with ourselves. We have to be. We're very, well, our limitations are right in our face. So that reality check can re-suffering in itself. If we, you know, aren't mindful of what's going on and come from that place of reacting to it. This is where so much frustration, disappointment, and doubt can arise. But it helps to remember when that's happening that this purification process is supposed to do this. We inevitably encounter everywhere in the heart and mind where that is not metta. We inevitably encounter all those places between ourselves and other people where the metta is blocked by any number of things. Preference, affinity, competing, judgment, hurt, resentment, anger, or simply blindness. The texts speak of barriers to metta, and they mean how we discriminate based on our preferences for or against different beings. And as we go through those categories, as you know, we encounter those barriers. And it's the function, that purification function of this practice, to break them down. Please remember, especially about preferences. We live in a social world, in a consensual reality that we can't ignore. And it's normal for preferences to play out in that realm. We associate with people we relate to. we prefer our family to strangers. Or I prefer the company of my Dhamma friends to, you know, old friends who might prefer getting drunk in a bar. What's the harm of that? It's natural, right? Yeah, well, it's important not to be confused about this. Because social roles, as opposed to heart preferences, are very different things. Because there are differences socially in roles and in preferences and in closeness. Even the Buddha spoke about this. You know, there was a sutta where he's talking about how, oh, look over there, there's Mahamoggallana with all his buddies who do, you know, the divine abodes, and there's Sariputta with all his buddies who, you know, they dwell in the realm of discrimination. And, you know, this is normal. People have been doing this since forever. But without wisdom and compassion, we can get confused about this. And those preferences can take over the mind and the heart and become a fixed stance from which we live. And become poisonous. And you see it on playgrounds all the time with little kids. Little kids are pretty transparent, and they can be incredibly cruel. I don't know if any of the rest of you have been bullied by somebody, but I certainly was as a kid. I think everybody has at some point. And, you know, little kids, they'd say, oh, you know, we're good, you're bad. Based on nothing, really. Hair color, the clothes you wear, whatever. And that in-group, out-group dynamic plays out in the adult world, too, in a much more subtle but equally vicious way. And if those kind of preferences become solidified into identity, this is what sets people against people, and ultimately nations against nations. Now, I don't have to say what's happening in the world out there right now. You all know that. And it's appalling. No. Us first. And the view of the Earth from space, or even from an airplane. I'm always struck when I fly. Like, for example, if I'm flying from Bangkok to Europe, and flying over parts of the world that are really, have been for a long time, war-torn, not peaceful places, but from 36,000 feet, they look very peaceful. You can't see where the boundaries are in the Middle East. Where's Iran? Where's Iraq? Where's Afghanistan? There's no sign on the mountains to say this. And we get complacent in this world. And I think those of us in the last 70 years or so who have not experienced a world war. You know, we think, oh, well, this is, peace is normal. But we've been incredibly fortunate that these preferences and identifications, you know, haven't created conditions once again for that kind of terrible, terrible global tragedy. And, you know, I look around the room and you're all Dhamma brothers and sisters. But we come from all over the place. It's really remarkable. 19 countries. everywhere I know. Russians and Americans are supposed to hate each other, right? It's the stupidest thing on the planet. Yeah, I could go on. But we see in this very precious container of retreat how baseless all of that nationality is. And yeah, we all relate to home. But we don't have to hold it as I, as me, as mine, and better than worse than. We don't have to go to that place that our parents or grandparents were living through, or they were killing each other. Literally, our parents or grandparents were killing each other. That's a sobering thought. It doesn't have to be that way. And what's the root of all of this? This samsaric messiness that starts on the playground and turns into world war and genocide. Ultimately, it's rooted in what in Pali is called atta, simply meaning self. And today I want to dissect this a little bit in the service of understanding the maker of these barriers. In the Majjhima Nikaya, one of my favorite suttas in the Majjhima is partly because I was at first attracted, I have to say, to the name of the sutta. It's the Honeyball Sutta. How could you not be attracted to a honeyball? And the Buddha is speaking about the maker of suffering. And he says, what one perceives that one thinks about. And what one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. In other words, we perceive something, we think about it, and then that thinking turns into mental proliferation. The Pali word for this is papancha, and I had to throw that in because I really love that word. Papancha is obsessive thinking, basically. Mental proliferation is a fancy way of putting it. But it's the kind of thought we mull over and over and over and over again and again and again, proliferating, magnifying, concretizing. So it's elaboration on any sense object that arises in our experience. Smothering that sense object with wave after wave after wave of mental constructions. Most of which is illusory, not real, repetitive, or even obsessive. And that effectively blocks any clarity we might have about what's actually going on. Andy Olensky puts it like this. He says, these are the narrative loops that play over and over in the mind. The trains of thought pulling out of the station one after another, taking us for a long ride down the track before we even know we're aboard. Yeah, it's like that. We don't even question this stuff. One of the most remarkable stories about perception and how we take things to be ours and what happens when that doesn't happen comes from a story that Oliver Sacks told. Oliver Sacks was just a brilliant writer and a neurologist and a wonderful human being who died a couple of years ago. And he wrote these wonderful books, one of which was called The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. That's not the story I want to tell. He wrote a little book called One Leg to Stand On. And it's his own story of having a really serious injury when he was hiking in Norway on a holiday. And he needed then to have an operation on his knee to put it back together. And the knee was in a cast for some time. And what happened is he lost the sense that this was his leg. The neural sense that this thing belonged to him. And he said it was as if there was a, like, the leg of a corpse or a cadaver in the bed with him. And he was so kind of shocked by this, that being the neurologist that he went through the literature and found out this is quite a common occurrence, and people even throw themselves out of bed because they're so horrified by this, you know, alien thing in the bed with them. They throw it out of the bed, but of course it's attached to their body, and they go out too. Yeah, so we have these perceptions. This is my leg. But it's just sense contact. And we make up this thing about, yes, my leg. And that's actually a normal and healthy perception, that, you know, this is my leg. But papancha can be even more destructive and illusion producing. So much of what we perceive in the world is like a magic show, and we take it to be true. I don't know how many of you have seen people who are skilled at magic, and they can do all sorts of things, and you can't even tell, well, how did they do that. Papancha is just as good, if not better, than the most skilled magician. Bhikkhu Bodhi calls it an eruption of mental commentary that obscures the bare data of cognition. Yeah, it's just... And a lot of it's not even thought. We don't even question it. These are the lenses that we see through. And we don't even know they're there. Because we're looking through them. They're transparent to us. This is the nature of delusion. And the trap comes when we believe everything we think, when we believe all this papancha. Because this is how that sense of I am and of identification and self-importance and self-righteousness, this is how these become solidified. And when atta, that sense of self, is solidified, what comes with it invariably is something in Pali called mana. And I'm amused by this word because in Hawaiian, mana means power. It's a positive thing. Oh, you say about somebody, oh boy, he's got a lot of mana. Right? This person has a lot of personal, has a real gravitas that people respect. But the Pali word mana means exactly the opposite. It means ultimately conceit. And conceit in quite a specific sense. Not conceit in the sense we use in English just to mean somebody who's, very proud. But it's any way that we can compare ourselves to somebody else. Combined with that, identification. So mana can take the form of superiority mana, which is conceit in the usual sense, inferiority mana, which is like chronic self-hatred. We're constantly putting ourselves down. Or equality mana, an aggressive sense that we're all the same, everything's alike. really denying outer conditions. So better than, worse than, equal to, is what mana boils down to. And it comes out in so many ways. We see it on retreat really vividly. Maybe we're sitting there at ease, quietly, and the person next to us is fidgeting, or they get up after 15 minutes. They can't sit for very long. And we sit there and we congratulate ourselves for being such a good yogi. Or maybe we walk across the floor and we glide. We don't make a sound and we're so proud of ourselves. And we think about that doofus that is always going thump, 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 and how much better we are. Or maybe we go through the day focusing on other people's shortcomings, totally oblivious to our own, but you know, out there. They're all doing this wrong or that badly, or you know, I'm doing better than them. And of course, the inferiority mana, that's the flip side to this. We're the worst yogi here. We're the one that can't sit, and everybody else is, you know, in some jhana or another, and we're just not getting it. Or maybe we've been practicing for a long time, like decades, and we think, you know, some of these young whippersnappers, they're really gifted, and I'm just grinding away. I'm never going to get anywhere. I can't do this. Or maybe it's equality, you know, it's like, oh yeah, we're all exactly the same. And this comparing is a habit we all have. We do it without thinking. There's sense contact and the comparing comes next, you know. There are many steps in between that, but it feels instantaneous. And it's not a personal failing, but part of the package of the human condition that we work with in the practice. Because most of us, to some extent or another, live with these things, being the lenses through which we see everything. Atta and mana are like evil twins. You know, where there is one, there is always the other. So when we're sucked into this papancha about me and how I relate to everybody else, you know, it concretizes that sense of identification. And so when we go through the practice and we experience interesting things in the practice, as we invariably do, when concentration comes, all sorts of things can happen. We can filled with fountains of metta, or lightness and bliss. Or maybe there's just a lot of vibration, and maybe really weird things start happening in the body. You know, like the sense of the body goes away, or maybe it morphs. So we're sitting there not moving and it feels like our hands are touching behind our backs. Or maybe we're experiencing something quite dramatic and different. It might not even be pleasant. But we can take these things that come with concentration and with deepening practice also as a focus of atta and mana. Me and my deep practice, or me and my bad practice. Take your pick. We'll go there, and sometimes it flips back and forth between the two. So, comparing like this concretizes those barriers. It's like going up to a wall and, you know, putting plaster on it. Or something, you know, that makes the wall even stronger. with that sense of self, that comparing, that builds those walls between ourselves and everybody in this room and everybody in the universe. These are the walls that metta begins to break down. And this is why the practice is arranged the way it is, because we want to start where it's easy. And it's easier to radiate metta to beings we like or prefer. And then we get to this neutral category, and we just like, huh? Who is this person? I have no idea. And we get to the enemy. I don't have to tell you how much fun that is, at first, at least. That person. They did that to me. How wrong they are. How bad they are. And these categories are sequentially more and more difficult because of the increasing potential for that self-involvement, that atta, that mana. My friend, my enemy. And that my getting more and more fixed and powerful. And one of the things that makes metta so peaceful when we finally access it is that those barriers of attachment and identification and atta and mana have broken down. And there's a habit of well-wishing that replaces that habit of making these people something to do with us or against us. Those habits of owning and preferring or disliking. And it's a substitution of opposites. Metta replaces, at least temporarily, all these states. And it's a process. So at first, of course, we can't immediately access this. And if you have preferences, you're not making a mistake. It's just a ripening. So I want to speak a little more, though, about this process of ripening as it pertains to that comparing that I was talking about. Because how we take this mana and turn it on ourselves and each other is such a feature of most people's retreat experience. And it's a painful feature of most people's retreat experience. We compare with ourselves, with each other, and we assess our practice based on that comparison. This is where it becomes really painful. What's most obvious is when we compare ourselves to each other, to somebody else. And one reason we advise to guard your eye door, to guard the senses, and not look around so much, is when we look around, we notice each other. And when we notice each other, it's the Honeyball Sutta all over again. We can proliferate quite a long time on what that other person is doing and how they're doing it and how they're better than us or worse than us, or maybe equal to us. All sorts of solid views and opinions begin to arise, and we see the whole retreat world through that. And unless we're Buddhas, we can't know what's happening, really, for somebody else. Just by looking at them, how they walk, how they eat, how they sit, or how long they sit for, or whatever criterion we use to judge other people. We can't tell what somebody's practice is like based on these things. We just don't know. But that doesn't stop us from doing it. I was once practicing in America at the Forest Refuge. This is a long time ago now, right after it first opened. And one of the other yogis has since become a very, very well-known concentration teacher. I didn't have anything good to think about her. As far as I was concerned, I couldn't figure out what she was doing there. But what did I know? You know, and she actually was my difficult person. She was a trigger. I'd see her and I'd go, oh, God. You know, my eyes would roll. There was no respect. I was so triggered by something, you know. She was a little too relaxed. I was very serious, and she was way too relaxed. It's funny and it's sad, because we all do this. So, of course, all of this is rooted in atta, mana, and then come judgment, self-righteousness, anger, disrespect, jealousy, even. All sorts of things can come from this, and none of them are fun. And this person, I met her for the first time in probably 15 years last year. She's quite delightful. I really like her. You know, and all of that, it's nothing. So if we remember about Papancha, this will help. Because there's no end to the number of ways we can look at somebody else and then proliferate based on one glance about them versus us, us versus them. And of course we suffer for that. Sylvia Boorstein, who's a lovely American teacher, she teaches a lot of metta. She quotes something, I think, from the Jewish tradition, I'm not sure. No, there are three kinds of business. My business, your business, and God's business. And there's only one kind of business anyone should be paying attention to, and it's, you know, my business. And that's one way of putting it, you know, it's like, we just practice. Take care of yourself. And never mind what other people are doing. Never mind if they're better than you in your perception. Never mind if they're worse than you in your perception. People are going to do all sorts of things. And we are going to do all sorts of things. I also remember my very first retreat, the very first day of my very first retreat. Somebody did something inconsiderate. And this is such a doorway in for me into, you know, actually what arose was fury, hatred. I knew this person well, and I was thinking all sorts of things about her. Fortunately, the practice held me in this. And this is actually why I'm sitting here today, ultimately. Because what that opened into was just vast metta. And it happened like that. It went from hatred to metta in an instant. And I was so stunned by that turnaround. Never in my entire life could I have imagined this, that it changed the whole trajectory of my life. So, people doing what people do, even if they're inconsiderate, this can be the ground of a a real mental turnaround, a turnaround of the heart. And I look back to those days of my own practice, and I really see it comes with a sense of, you know, holding it at arm's length with a little disgust. I see how there was such a sense of rigidity, and I was being very dogmatic. You had to be a certain way in the practice. And only certain kinds of behavior were acceptable, and what she was doing was certainly not. And you know, all she was doing, she came to breakfast late so that I, as the table wiper, had to work around her. That was all it was. And the mind was catapulted into rage. And then, with the practice, turned into metta. Not just for her, but for everybody in the retreat. So take these places of dogmatic rigidity as the ground for the practice. Because we all have ideas about the practice, and they conflict. That's the blunt way of putting it. Somebody might look at one person and say, oh, they're too rigid. They might look back and say, oh, they're too relaxed. Who knows who's doing the better practice? From the outside, you can't tell. And if we think people have to be a certain way in a retreat, if they deviate from that, whether they're too, well, too whatever, whether they're too relaxed or too uptight, too focused or too floaty, maybe they walk too much or sit too long. They're lightweights or they're heavyweights. That's all external comparison. Because when we look at somebody like that, you know, there's a, I think it's an American Indian saying that says, when you point your finger at somebody, there are three other fingers pointing back at you. You know, we're immediately pointing at ourselves. If I say, oh, you're too focused, I'm immediately saying about myself, well, I'm relaxed. So there, you know, that comparison is toxic. And of course, the mana that comes in there, better than, worse than, equal to, is toxic. But it doesn't stop there. Comparison and assessing, you know, how we judge ourselves and others based on comparison, can happen internally too. And there's so many manifestations of this. If we're experienced yogis, if we've done a lot of sitting, we compare ourselves with how it was on the last retreat, what we could experience, how our sittings were. And then we get quite competitive with ourselves. Oh, I'm better than, getting better, or I'm worse than. You know, then we get all demoralized. Or we compare ourselves and our practice to some kind of arbitrary idea of how we think the practice should be unfolding. And this second kind of comparison is very interesting because sometimes we don't even notice we're doing it. In the metta practice, it's not so predominant, but in the vipassana practice, where we think we have a map, this is how the practice should be unfolding, and this is the stage at which I am. And so, if we're experienced, we sit down and we go, oh, that's that place in the practice. And we do it with the metta practice too, because as we deepen in concentration, we start to have these little experiences. And we say, oh, the sense of the body's disappeared. Oh, good, I'm there in the practice. Or, oh, yeah, there's all that vibration. Ah, that's that place in the practice. Or maybe we feel the breath as it comes and goes, and we realize, oh, yeah, yeah, no, I know that place. It's all really relaxed. And we have these little landmarks, and we think we know where we are in the practice, in the concentration, and how we're doing. And so we score our sitting based on what's happening. Oh, this is a good sitting, this is a bad sitting, because of all these little landmarks that we might be recognizing. And to a certain extent, these things do happen. You know, there is, for each of us, a fairly predictable process that unfolds as we go down through the layers of concentration, or down into the layers of concentration. But to make a map out of this and then to assess our practice based on that is the problem. This is when we become identified with it. And we try to reproduce something. And those of us maybe who haven't practiced as much, we can still have maps based on what we've read, what we've heard other people talking about. And we hear people talk about bliss and we think, oh, I don't have any bliss. I must be doing it wrong. Or we think, oh, the metta should be some certain kind of feeling and I'm not feeling that at all. I must be doing it wrong. And we take these ideas based on what we've read or what other people have said to, you know, delineate what we think the practice should look like. And we assess ourselves. We grade ourselves. A, B, C, D. Oh, you're flunking. You know, you get an F for this sitting. But here's the thing to not forget. Deepening in the practice is always a surprise. Here we are in this present moment of now, and you have no idea, I have no idea what's going to happen in the next moment. I mean, I think I'm going to be sitting here talking, and you'll be listening for a little while longer anyway. But who knows? There might be some huge earthquake, and we all go screaming out of the room. I don't know. We might all be instantly enlightened. You know, there are an infinite number of possibilities. So when you practice, each moment, be there for that with a mind that doesn't assume it knows what's going on. Fortunately, with the metta practice, this is a little easier to do than the vipassana practice. Somebody was mentioning that in their interview the other day. It's like, yeah, I'm used to vipassana and I'm used to that progress. But here it's like, well, whatever. And that can actually be quite a relief. And be careful to see if you're making a map, if you're constructing a map as you go along, based on your experiences this month, that you'll then carry around until the next retreat and then go, oh, yes, vibration, check. No sense of self, check. Oh, I'm getting an A. You know, I laugh about this because we all do it. But that's just comparing. That's an internal version of mana. You know, we're comparing ourselves with ourselves, some past version of us. One example in the metta practice of this, you know, it's like, we talk a lot about metta being cool and peaceful. And we say it so much, we know it's being heard by everybody. You know, cool and peaceful, it's easily understood language too. But I can't count the number of times people have said, to me, and I'm sure then also to Aria and Saito and any other teacher. Well, my metta isn't, you know, my metta is, you know, just warm and wonderful, but then it went away. And it's just cool and peaceful. What am I doing wrong? We think the metta should be warm and, you know, flowing love, and, you know, we don't really hear the cool and peaceful part. So we assess our practice based on some idea we have of how metta should be. So please feel free to take those assessments and say, thank you for sharing, I don't know. Because we have no idea what will happen. And when we can rest in that place of no idea what will happen next, we're freed from the prison of anticipation that says, oh, I know something's going to happen. We're free from assessing, oh, this is better than before or worse than before. Or because this is happening, it must mean I'm a good yogi or a bad yogi. And we're freed from mistaken ideas of progress. You know, like what happened to my metta feeling? It's gone. I must be going backwards. When in fact the practice is progressing. So, not to try to second guess, we say in English, the practice. To jump ahead, to, you know, assume it's going to go in a certain way. So these assessments of ourselves and each other, these comparisons, and the ego's entanglement with all of that, a lot of that ego entanglement is coming into vivid focus right now because the ego isn't going to lie down without a fight and go away. All the snakes are coming out of their holes for everybody. If it's not metta, you get to see it. And we know it's not easy. These can be the places where we're the most deeply challenged in the practice. And this is why Sayadaw and the Buddha always speak about patience, which is never good news, actually, when you receive that advice. It's like, oh, great, thank you. In the Dhammapada, there's a verse in the Dhammapada I know we've quoted before, cultivating the wholesome, refraining from the unwholesome, and purifying the mind. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. Well, the very next line after that is, patience is the highest renunciation. In other words, there's this, you know, this purifying, this restraint, but please be patient. Because many things can arise and will arise. And patience is being willing to live through this. Whatever it is, supported by the understanding that the only way out of this suffering is through it, and that we can do that. The last part, that we can do that, is confidence, faith. And at first we need outside verification of that. We want validation of our experience. And it's such a common question to receive from people. I experienced such and such. Fill in the blank. Is this okay? Is this the right understanding? Is this correct? Some version of that question. In other words, is this really going in the right direction? Am I doing this right? And that lack of self-confidence is natural at the beginning of the practice. And it can be very good to ask those questions if we're not sure. And the beginning of a practice can mean the first week or the first 30 years, depending. But the more skilled we get, and the more we see the ups and downs of the practice in our own experience, and we see the simplicity of the practice and how it brings results, we gain a verified faith in ourselves and in the process itself. We're more at ease with the ups and downs because we understand it's in the falling down and the getting up a million times that the practice works. And we understand that sometimes we need to back off, and that's okay. Sometimes we can make more effort, and that's okay. And we don't have to ask somebody whether we should do that or not. And we gain faith in the form and the technique because we see, actually, it may seem really stupid, but pragmatically, it works really well. It does its job. And we gain faith in the metta itself and our ability to access it. Even when we're experiencing super intense things, and we understand that metta is well-wishing, so we're no longer afraid of merging with others. And that we have faith that the metta can hold whatever is arising, no matter how kind of wild it might be. It's this confidence, it's this faith in the process that allows this ego unbinding to happen. It's what allows us to put aside those habits of atta and mana and pick up another habit of metta. And, you know, we're all, each of us, in that messy middle ground between delusion and freedom, where we see reactivity, but sometimes we can't stop it. Or maybe we're not really sure how to deal with it yet, skillfully. But confidence gives us the ability to simply keep going, to keep just one step at a time, even if we're not completely certain, to go forward, to follow the instructions and see what happens, to make mistakes, to fall down and get up over and over again. And here's where we do our own learning. And this is where confidence deepens, because we can say things, the same things over and over again up here, giving you instructions on how to work with difficult states, how to acknowledge them, put them aside, and, you know, just hold them with metta. Don't go into that train of thought, we say. Be patient, persistent. Have the determination to reincline the mind to metta, even if you don't want to go there. We can say these things over and over again, but how you manage your difficult ego rebellion, when the ego begins to, you know, get worn away and it fights back, how you manage that is your own koan, your own question to answer for yourself. We can't answer that for you specifically. We can give you those general instructions. But it's in the practice, in the falling down and getting up a gazillion times, that you learn that for yourself. remembering that line of the Buddha that we quoted before, whatever we think or frequently ponder upon, that becomes the inclination of the mind, and just inclining to metta, having patience. And remembering that when things go out of balance, it's not that the practice doesn't work. It's just that things have gone out of balance. Oh well, now what? You know, now what do we do? Oh, incline to metta. May I be at ease anyway. And remembering that the whole process takes time. And often, here's the hard part to take in, at least for me, more time than I would like. We just get sick and tired of it all, don't we? We lose patience. We want to be done with it now. Not some lifetime. Thank you very much. Sick of this. I think of this in side by side with a story a dear friend told in a Dhamma talk of taking her daughter on a walk through Haleakala Crater in Hawaii. And it's a long, arduous walk. Her daughter was a young teenager, and they're down in the bottom of the crater, which is a long walk down and then a long walk back up. And her daughter just sits down and says, "I'm done, I want a helicopter." We all know this state. But in the practice, there are no helicopters. I'm sorry to say. That's where this patience comes in. Being patient with the process and patient with yourself. And to undo these illusions of the ego that create suffering, that create the barriers to metta. Trungpa Rinpoche says this: "It's important to see the main point of any spiritual practice is to step out of the bureaucracy of the ego. This means stepping out of the ego's constant desire for higher, better, more spiritual, a more transcendent version of knowledge, religion, virtue, judgment, comfort, or whatever the particular ego is seeking. So to get off that hamster wheel of chasing that stuff, those things the ego wants, all that comparison, all that assessing, all those spiritual goodies, that enlightenment even, and just keep walking. Even if you have no idea where it's going, please continue," is the instruction we get from the sayadaws. Often there's no more than that. And a yogi said the other day, and I was so touched by this, they said, it was the first thing they said when they walked in the room, they said, "You know what? I have no idea where this is going. And I'm okay with that." Exactly. Please continue. So thank you for your kind attention. And may we all have the patience with this process to simply keep going, finding our way through the thickets of conceit and identification to the pure boundlessness of metta. Thank you for your kind attention, and thank you for your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.